The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the October 11th, 2024 issue of The Week. Our cover drawing this week shows Benjamin Netanyahu. He's standing in front of a bulletin board, smiling at the viewer. There are pinned up on the bulletin board seven pictures of Middle Eastern leaders, military, and political leaders of the terrorist groups that Israel's fighting against. Netanyahu has a red marker in his hand, and he has X'd out five of the seven. There are two others still up there. The headline is Targeting Terror. After decapitating Hezbollah, will Israel take aim at Iran? We will pick up that story in one of the columns. But we'll start with the two shorter main stories, first of which certainly hits quite close to home. Southeast digs out after deadly hurricane. What happened? Southern Appalachia began its long recovery from Hurricane Helene this week after the monster storm dumped more than 40 trillion gallons of rain on six states, killing at least 160 people and leaving hundreds missing. Helene slammed Florida as a massive Category 4 hurricane, causing 15-foot storm surges before barreling through Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia, and wreaking $35 billion worth of damages. At least 1.5 million people lost power. Mountainous western North Carolina, seldom touched by hurricanes, took 2 feet of rain, causing catastrophic flooding and mudslides that cut off dozens of towns. With roads washed out, residents of Asheville were stranded without clean water, power, or phone service. President Biden ordered 1,000 active military troops to assist FEMA rescue teams in getting aid through using helicopters and ATVs, while volunteers lent their own pack mules to deliver supplies. "We'll take our chainsaws," said local rancher Mike Toberer, "and we'll push those mules through." Donald Trump, visiting Georgia, falsely accused President Biden of refusing calls from Republican state leaders there, and falsely said North Carolina's Governor Roy Cooper, a Democrat, had failed to assist Republican counties. As president, Trump had threatened to withhold emergency aid from Democratic-run states. Vice President Kamala Harris, who also visited Georgia, said she and Biden were doing everything they could to make sure that the federal resources hit the ground as quickly as possible. What the columnist said: "It's times like these that we recognize the value of good government," said the Charlotte Observer in an editorial. "Federal agencies provide a lifeline to flood victims, yet too many politicians want to dismantle the very things that are helping people. For example, Project 2025, the plan for a second Trump term co-written by many former Trump administration staffers, would gut the National Weather Service and limit disaster aid. Yet our so-called big government is saving Carolinian lives." "Asheville was supposed to be a climate haven," said Kate Aronoff in The New Republic, "protected by mountains from severe storms and extreme heat. But the new reality of global warming is that nowhere will be spared. And that means that all policy is climate policy, not just that governing energy or emissions, but also housing and international trade. When Helene hit Spruce Pine, North Carolina, it halted mining at one of the world's only sources of the high-purity quartz used in microchips, threatening supply chains." The devastation could affect the presidential election, said Amy Gardner and Colby Itkowitz in the Washington Post. Early voting begins on October 17th in North Carolina, a battleground decided in 2020 by less than 80,000 votes. Yet many polling places will be inaccessible. Especially worrisome is how to ensure voting by mail, given that many residents have fled the area and won't receive their ballots. The challenging circumstances could suppress turnout and possibly change the allocation of the state's 16 electoral votes. Vance Waltz spar in VP debate. What happened? In a notably civil vice presidential debate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance this week portrayed Donald Trump's presidency as an epoch of security and prosperity, while Minnesota Governor Tim Walz promised steady leadership under Kamala Harris and condemned his opponent's record on January 6 and abortion rights. Vance credited Trump-era tax cuts with kickstarting an economic boom unlike we've seen in a generation, and said Vice President Harris was complicit in Biden administration policies that make life unaffordable for Americans. On abortion, Vance acknowledged that Republicans had to earn people's trust back, but echoed Trump's contention that restrictions should be left to the states. In response, Waltz highlighted cases of women who died in states with abortion restrictions. How can we, Waltz asked, conclude that a right as basic as the right to control your own body is determined on geography? He stumbled elsewhere, and after being questioned about a claim that he was in Hong Kong during the Tiananmen Square massacre, acknowledged he misspoke and could be a knucklehead at times. But Waltz regained some momentum when Vance deflected a question about who won the 2020 election by saying he was focused on the future, yielding what Waltz called a damning non-answer. What the columnist said. Vance won, said Jeffrey Blehar in National Review, and in the best possible way. He abandoned the alienating culture war chatter that Waltz labeled weird and delivered a master class in intelligent populist politics. Poor Waltz looked perpetually hapless as Vance made his case that the Biden-Harris administration has left America poorer, less safe, and less in control of its own destiny. Fluent in policy details, he put flesh on the bones of Trumpism in ways that Trump himself, with his erratic debate performance and social media venom, struggles to do. Waltz had many missed opportunities to correct Vance's lies, said Jim Newell in Slate, letting him get away with suggesting that bringing back offshore manufacturing jobs would fix climate change or that Trump salvaged Obamacare. Still, Waltz did tee up Vance's worst moment of the night, his refusal to admit Trump lost in 2020, and his counterfactual insistence that Trump peacefully gave over power. Remember, whoever becomes vice president will be the one certifying elections. Usually, vice presidential debates don't matter, said William Crystal in the Bulwark. Not this time. Vance likely boosted Trump's prospects in subtle ways that instant polls showing the debate a tie don't capture. His lack of vitriol makes Trumpism more palatable. And Waltz, by conceding so much to Vance's reasonableness, relinquished a chance to underscore the dangers of the Trump-Vance ticket. This was a performance that could make normie Republicans and independents more comfortable with the idea of a convicted criminal and election denier retaking the White House. Controversy of the week. Harris. Will her call for filibuster reform backfire? Depending on who you ask, said Riley Began in USA Today, the arcane Senate oddity known as the filibuster is either a hindrance or a protector for democracy. For Vice President Kamala Harris, that rule, which sets a 60-vote threshold for legislation to pass the Senate, is emphatically the former. Speaking to Wisconsin Public Radio last week, the Democratic nominee said that if elected president, she would push to eliminate the filibuster for bills related to reproductive freedom, so Democrats could restore the federal abortion protections lost when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. The political calculation here is simple, said Robert Tate in The Guardian. Polls show Harris has a wafer-thin lead over Donald Trump, and in the election's home stretch, she wants to elevate the issue of abortion, a priority for many women voters, and a weak spot for Trump. But her call to scrap the filibuster has troubled centrists in both parties, and a call to scrap, and earned her a tongue lashing from departing West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, a former Democrat turned independent. Shame on her, Manchin said. She knows the filibuster is the holy grail of democracy. It's the only thing that keeps us talking and working together. Manchin needn't fear his precious filibuster, said Jim Newell in Slate. Senate rules are set by senators, not the president, and Republicans are heavily favored to retake the chamber next month. Even if Democrats beat the odds, they'd need 100% of their caucus to enact changes, and if they cleared that hurdle to reform the filibuster, well, so what? This supposed holy grail of democracy does not appear in the Constitution, but is in fact a 19th century parliamentary quirk that only became a regular tool for blocking bills in the 1990s. Since then, both parties have created multiple carve-outs, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine, including for pushing through budget legislation. Doesn't a fundamental right like bodily autonomy deserve a filibuster carve-out of its own? The carving won't stop there, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Given the chance, Democrats will scrap the filibuster to expand the Supreme Court, grant statehood to Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico, and basically ram through the entirety of their left-wing agenda. Harris should proceed carefully, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. The ping-pong nature of Senate control means one party's exception is inevitably followed by another. Democrats ended the filibuster for lower court judges in 2013. Then Republicans did the same for Supreme Court nominees 4 years later, paving the way for today's ultra-conservative high court. The filibuster is infuriating and undemocratic, except, that is, when it is a welcome guardrail against extremism. How many guardrails do we need? Asked Perry Bacon Jr., also in the Post. Without the filibuster, bills would still have to pass two chambers, be signed by the president, and survive the gauntlet of the federal judiciary. Any extreme law that made it through these veto points could simply be undone by voters at the next election. There's a political science term for that system, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. Democracy. Yes, there's a risk to letting parties who win majorities pass laws and enact their agenda. Sometimes the wrong party wins. But living through those setbacks, as all of us would periodically in a post-filibuster America, would be a small price to pay for a government that can actually govern and act to deal with the problems of the day. It's a good week, bad week piece. It's a good week for survivors. After Jimmy Carter celebrated his 100th birthday, becoming the first former U.S. president to hit that milestone. Carter entered hospice care more than a year ago with cancer of the brain and liver. He's just a great guy, said his former physician, David Lawson. I wish him a happy birthday and many more to come. It was a good week for spares. After the Earth acquired a second moon, a 32-foot-wide asteroid known as 2024 PT5 that's expected to stay in our orbit for 2 months. Astronomer Jennifer Millard said the rock will then escape Earth's gravity and continue on its merry way through space. It was a good week for the supply closet. after Russian health minister Yevgeny Shestopolov urged workers to engage in procreation during breaks to help reverse the nation's plummeting birth rate. Being very busy at work is not a valid reason, but a lame excuse, said Shestopolov. But it was a bad week for authenticity. After Ohio Renaissance Festival, a whimsical recreation of life in electricity-free 16th century Europe, announced it was closing for a day due to a power outage. In a statement, organizers thanked our community for understanding. It was a bad week for Toucan Sam after California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a law that bans public schools from serving the food dyes that color Fruit Loops and other brightly hued processed foods. The additives have been linked to hyperactivity and other behavioral problems. Finally, it was a bad week for Mark Robinson after the GOP scandal-plagued gubernatorial candidate in North Carolina was treated for second-degree burns after touching a truck's exhaust pipe at a campaign event. Robinson told reporters that he was climbing down from the cabin of a big rig when, doggone if I didn't lay my hand on that tailpipe. Here's a short another news piece. Biden administration expands its asylum crackdown. President Biden this week put tougher restrictions on asylum applications at the U.S.-Mexico border, bolstering a June executive order. The June rule authorized border agents to turn back asylum seekers if the number of migrants trying to enter the country at official border crossings hit 2,500 a day. Daily numbers would have to average below 1,500 a day for a week in order for those restrictions to be lifted. Under the new rules, the daily numbers will need to average below 1,500 for 28 days before restrictions can be dropped. Since the June rules were put in place, arrests for illegal entry have plummeted to about 1,800 daily, the lowest number in 4 years, after peaking in December at about 8,000 daily. The American Civil Liberties Union and other activists who call the Biden's policy inhumane are currently challenging the executive order in court. We're at the briefing now. Title this week, The High Cost of Cheap Clothes. Americans are addicted to inexpensive, fast fashion. Are workers and the environment paying the price? What is fast fashion? The term emerged in the 1990s when European retailers such as Zara and H&M swapped the idea of fashion seasons for collections that change every month. While a traditional retailer may offer 1,000 different styles a year, fast fashion brands release up to 20,000 a year. And by keeping inventory low, deploying data and analytics to rapidly identify new consumer trends, and using just-in-time production lines to quickly churn out clothes, those businesses typically have higher profit margins than slower traditional retailers. But the first generation of fast fashion firms is now being outpaced and underpriced by Chinese e-retailers such as Temu and Shein, which each ship roughly 1 million packages a day to America. Shein pumps out a whopping 1.5 million styles a year, from $4 bikinis to $22 Air Jordan-like sneakers, and accounts for about half of the $41 billion a year U.S. fast fashion market. Social media is littered with videos from influencers and ordinary users showing off their Shein hauls, in which they rip open bags filled with cut-price apparel. But as those ultra-fast fashion firms have boomed in popularity, they have faced mounting accusations that their business models are built on labor abuse, tax avoidance, and planet-wrecking waste. Fast fashion is far from cheap, said Dillis Williams, a professor at the London College of Fashion. Someone, somewhere, is paying the real price. How do these companies keep prices low? The Chinese e-retailers say they are simply nimbler and more efficient than their rivals. Shein uses artificial intelligence to comb social media and online shopping sites and feeds trending items to designers who whip up new looks. Those designs are then sent to suppliers that make limited runs of the items and ramp up production if they sell well. It takes about 10 days to go from design to production, about 1/20th the time for traditional competitors. We're really a different model from fast fashion, said Peter Pernodet, head of communications at Shein. A U.S. tax loophole known as the de minimis clause, which lets imports worth less than $800 enter the U.S. duty-free, has also helped. Shein and Temu undercut the competition. Unlike traditional retailers that send foreign-made goods in bulk to warehouses, the Chinese retailers ship individual orders directly to consumers. As a result, Shein and Temu paid nothing to import duties in 2022. According to a congressional report, while Gap paid $700 million and H&M paid $205 million, critics say ultra-fast fashion firms further drive down their prices by exploiting workers. Are workers mistreated? The factory workers in southern China that make Shein's $5 crop tops and $10 flare jeans routinely work 12-hour days, 6 or 7 days a week, according to a recent report by Public Eye, a Swiss human rights advocacy group. It found workers typically earn between $830 and $1,380 a month. But after deducting pay for overtime, monthly wages dropped to $330. I take one day off each month, one worker told Public Eye. I can't afford any more. Shein said it does not recognize many of the allegations in the report. Workers' rights groups allege that such abuses are endemic across the entire fast fashion industry. In Bangladesh, where fast fashion accounts for 80% of export earnings, the nearly 600,000 people who make clothes for H&M suppliers earned an average of $119 a month in the first half of 2023. Anger over low pay exploded last October when garment workers set fire to factories and smashed up sewing machines. This entire industry is built off our backs, said worker Naima Islam. The least we can deserve is the bare minimum to survive. Is fast fashion bad for the environment? By encouraging consumers to constantly update their wardrobes, the industry generates vast amounts of waste. Shoppers typically wear fast fashion garments only 6 or 7 times, according to consulting firm McKinsey. For every 5 items produced, 3 end up in landfills or are incinerated. These are disposable fashion companies, said Maxime Bedat of the fashion think tank New Standard Institute. This stuff is not meant to last. Secondhand markets are so overwhelmed with clothes that some dump unwanted apparel in the wilderness. One pile of discarded fabrics in the middle of Chile's Atacama Desert weighs up to 59,000 tons, the equivalent of 2 Brooklyn bridges. Meanwhile, most items sold by Shein and similar brands are made of petroleum-based synthetic fibers, such as polyester and nylon, which are less durable than natural fibers and have a bigger carbon footprint. According to its own reporting, Shein's carbon emissions have nearly tripled in the last 3 years, hitting 18 million tons in 2023, the equivalent of 4 coal-fired power plants. The company says it aims to be carbon neutral by 2050. Can regulators rein in the industry? The Biden administration last month proposed new rules to curtail the overuse and abuse of the de minimis loophole, which would force Shein and Temu to pay import duties on goods shipped directly to American shoppers. U.S. safety regulators are also calling on officials to step up their investigation of Shein and Temu. South Korean authorities recently reported that multiple products sold by the firms contain worryingly high levels of toxic substances, including carcinogens and fertility-damaging plasticizers. The company said they rapidly pulled the goods after learning of the claims. But some experts say that true reform will require not just tougher action from authorities, but also for Americans to stop buying so many cheap clothes. Consumers are making statements that they want to purchase more ethically, said Divya D'Amato, CEO of supply chain consultancy GoodOps, but they're not really showing that on the scale that is necessary to make brands act. Time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Is Trump's derangement still news? It's evidently no longer news when Donald Trump engages in extreme racist and violent ranting at his rallies, said Michael Tomasky. Fearing defeat by Kamala Harris, he is barking out hatred and bile like a mad dog. Yet his raving gets little coverage in the mainstream media. At a rally last week, Trump called Harris mentally disabled and a very dumb person, and said that unlike Joe Biden, she was born that way. Trump also called migrants vile animals, murderers, and thugs who will walk into your kitchen, they'll cut your throat. He said voters had no choice but elect him so he can rid America of these monsters. Otherwise, he warned, you're going to lose your culture. Trump even said that Fox News should not be allowed to cover Harris' visit to the border. Whether a man who uses such unhinged rhetoric is mentally fit to serve 4 years as the world's toughest job is a very real and pressing question. But the press isn't giving it enough attention, perhaps because Trump's derangement no longer seems new. But doesn't the media have a responsibility to warn voters just how demented Trump has become? The sane washing continues. A mysterious decline in overdoses. Drug deaths are finally declining, said Jacob Sullum, and nobody really knows why. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently released data indicating a 10% drop in overdoses over the past year to 112,470. But as researchers have pointed out, the government's war on drugs cannot plausibly explain it. Most drug seizures at the border are still marijuana and methamphetamine, not fentanyl, the power synthetic opioid that is responsible for about two-thirds of overdoses. The street price of the drugs is actually declining, including plenty of availability. A campaign to flood the country with naloxone, a life-saving opioid antagonist that's now available over the counter, could be partly responsible for the decline. But it's also possible that opioid users have learned to become more cautious about fentanyl-laced street drugs. Prohibition of drug sales and use has never been effective, and in fact has contributed to the overdose epidemic by creating a black market in which quality and purity are highly variable and unpredictable. The failed war on drugs deserves a large share of the blame for creating a situation in which an annual toll of more than 100,000 drug deaths looks like an improvement. This column comes from Lebanon in reference to our cover drawing. Can Hezbollah survive the death of its leader? Love him or hate him, you could not help but respect Hezbollah leader Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, said Agni Altaki in El Shark from Lebanon. The Shiite cleric and politician was killed last week in a massive Israeli airstrike that obliterated several buildings in Beirut. He apparently suffocated to death in his bunker. It was a sad end for the man who has transformed Hezbollah into a lethal force, boasting some 100,000 armed men and thousands of missiles and rockets, and had worked day and night for the cause of Palestine. With a talent for oratory and a sense of humor rare among resistance leaders, he could charm and inspire even some of those Lebanese who didn't support his Iran-backed militia. Under his 3 decades of stewardship, the Party of God battled Israel to a stalemate in the 2006 Israel-Lebanon War and battled Israel and rescued Syria's Bashar al-Assad from being toppled in the Syrian Civil War. Now he is a martyr, victim of the criminal butcher of the Middle East, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Yet it wasn't just in Tel Aviv that they danced and rejoiced at his death, said Shimrit Meir. Syrians and Lebanese all over the world also distributed sweets. They hated Nasrallah for turning Lebanon, a multi-ethnic country home to various Islamic and Christian sects, into a bankrupt outpost of the Shiite Iran. While Hezbollah adherents saw him as a kind of demigod, said Eli Fayyad, for most of us, he was the head of a clandestine foreign-backed power that undermined our state. Under his guidance, the group assassinated Rafik Hariri, the former prime minister and revered Lebanese statesman, in 2005. Its military wing funded and armed other Iranian proxy groups in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq. And its political wing, the most powerful force in Lebanese politics, was reactionary and obscurantist influence, opposed to any in-depth reform of our deeply divided society. For decades, Hezbollah has been the major obstacle to national unity because it has unilaterally launched destructive wars that invited retribution against all of Lebanon. The Lebanese blame Nasrallah for making their country into a failed state, said Fasil J. Abbas in Arab News. But his death is a great opportunity. Israel hasn't just killed Nasrallah. It has also assassinated Hezbollah's top generals and political commanders. That means that even if the group were to live on, it would most likely be a caricature of its former self. The exploding pager attacks that maimed thousands of militants last month, and the bombings that killed Hezbollah bigwigs gathered for secret meetings, show either that Israel has superior intelligence capabilities, or that Hezbollah has been infiltrated, or most probably both. Indeed, Hezbollah's most successful attack against Israel all year succeeded only in destroying a chicken coop. Lebanon now needs outside help so it can forge a new identity freed from the militants' grasp. The international community should pressure Israel to agree to a ceasefire as soon as possible, and foreign humanitarian aid and assistance to the wounded and displaced needs to start pouring in. Otherwise, the power vacuum in Lebanon could lead to another civil war. The last word, our feature article, title this week, Fast Food Justice. When a customer threw a Chipotle burrito bowl, a judge thought he had just the right sentence, said Reeves Weideman in New York Magazine. But creative punishment can't fix a country boiling over. It was a simple order. White rice, chicken, sour cream, and cheese. No pinto beans or veggies. No salsa or guac. Just a pile of basic burrito bowl ingredients in varying shades of white. There should have been no room for drama. The order came into the Chipotle in Parma, a working-class suburb of Cleveland, on a Tuesday night last September. The dinner rush was on, and like pretty much every restaurant coming out of the COVID era, this Chipotle was short-staffed. The line wrapped around the dining area all the way to the door and was moving so slowly that one customer, Rosemary Hain, decided to try pulling a modern trick. She opened the Chipotle app on her phone, placed her order, and stepped out of line. But as Hain waited, 5 minutes, then 15, she watched the flow of orders get backed up. Her attempt to game the system had failed. What Hain saw as an infuriating delay was, for Emily Russell, the restaurant's 25-year-old assistant manager, a daily gauntlet. When the steak ran out, she fired up the grill. When the online orders backed up, she hopped over to help a teenage employee trying to keep pace. It was at this point in the night that Russell heard a commotion. A woman in a black T-shirt, pink shorts, and flip-flops, Rosemary Hain, was complaining that her burrito bowl, a monochromatic one, had not only taken forever to make, but that it had come out looking disgusting. Russell apologized, explaining that the restaurant was understaffed. She didn't see anything especially wrong with the order. The bowl wasn't stuffed full, but Hain had only ordered 4 ingredients. Russell remade it anyway to keep the line moving, filling the bowl beyond the standard portions mandated by Chipotle's corporate office. But Hain said the new bowl still looked like shit. The line was growing, and Russell said there wasn't anything more she could do. "I'm going to give you this food because there's nothing wrong with it," Russell said. Hain left in a huff, and the line got moving again, until she returned a few minutes later. Hain had gone to a car to show the bowl to her daughter, who agreed with her mother's assessment. "Would you eat this?" Hain said to the other customers still waiting in line. "Would you eat this?" She slammed the burrito bowl down on the counter, demanding that someone other than Russell remake it yet again. Russell refused, but gave her a card with the manager's number to sort that out if she wanted. As the line of customers looked on, Hain seemed to pause for a moment and think about leaving the restaurant and moving on. Instead, something in Hain cracked. She reared back and threw the bowl in Russell's face. Hain turned and made for the exit. An older woman jumped out of line to try to stop her, while other people pulled out their phones to film the incident. One customer had been recording when Hain threw the bowl and uploaded her video to the r/public freakout channel on Reddit that night. It went viral, but not as viral as what happened next. In late November, 2 months after the incident, Judge Timothy Gilligan played the video in Parma Municipal Court. "You didn't get your burrito bowl the way you like it, and this is how you respond," Gilligan said. "This is not Real Housewives of Parma." He suggested to Hain that she must have gone to the restaurant looking for a fight. "I did not, Your Honor," Hain said. "If I showed you how my food looked, it was disgusting." "I would be disgusted by that food," Gilligan said. "I'll bet you're not going to be happy with the food you're about to get in jail." Gilligan wasn't sure what to do with Hain. The maximum sentence for a crime, one account of assault, was 180 days in jail. She didn't seem especially contrite, but Russell wasn't badly hurt. Gilligan wanted to find a way to make her see the situation from Russell's point of view. He decided to offer Hain an unusual deal. He was sentencing her to 90 days in jail, but with a chance to shave off 60 days if she spent 2 months working in a fast food restaurant for at least 20 hours a week, an experiment in forced empathy. "Do you want to walk in her shoes for 2 months?" and learn how people should treat people? Gilligan asked. Or do you want to do your jail time? Hain agreed to give empathy a try. I'd like to walk in her shoes, she said. When Rosemary Hain came into Judge Gilligan's courtroom, he had served on the bench in Parma for 30 years. Gilligan told me the deal he gave Hain was an unusual departure for him from traditional sentencing guidelines. The only similar punishment he could recall giving out went to a local slumlord who was leaving basic maintenance undone. Gilligan sentenced him to live in one of his derelict units for 6 months, with an ankle bracelet to confirm that he was sleeping there. All those things got fixed before he got out, Gilligan said. This wasn't about punishment, Gilligan said. This was about gaining empathy. But if there was a flaw in Gilligan's experiment, it was the fact that Rosemary Hain wasn't blind to how difficult a fast food worker's life could be. In fact, she knew it well. Hain had worked at a McDonald's as well as a Burger King in the 2000s. She knew how unpleasant the work could be. You don't get paid shit, and people are so rude, Hain said. Being around food, my clothes smelling greasy like food. Being greasy, I swore to God I would never work in fast food again. I did my time. Hain's life had been marked by challenges. Her mother died when she was 20, at which point Hain was already pregnant with her second child. I was pregnant at 17 years old, so my whole life has been taking care of my kids, she said. I don't bar hop. I don't kick it in clubs. I live a lame mom life. She had been with her husband for 20 years, and they had 3 daughters. After her time in fast food, Hain went on to work at a dollar store and a CVS, and more recently as a third-party delivery driver for a company she asked me not to name. She liked that job better. She didn't have to deal with a boss or anyone else, given that the customers ordered their items online and just like she had with her burrito. Hain and her husband worked together. He drove, she delivered the packages, showing up to a distribution center at 3:30 or 4 in the morning to pick up a route that was estimated to take 5 hours. Working together, they could finish more quickly and fast enough to get home and drive their youngest daughter to school and their middle child to work. My normal life is waking up 3 in the effing morning to run a marathon, Hain told me. Hain objected to the notion that she needed to learn how to be empathetic, but she was grateful for Gilligan's sentence. To get that rather than have to sit in jail, amen, thank you, Hain told me. Let me go to Burger King and be their bitch for real. Her first task was to find a job. She thought about not mentioning the incident in interviews, but didn't want to deal with her boss finding out midway through. Hain says she was turned away by Subway, Chick-fil-A, and 4 different McDonald's. She didn't try Chipotle. In January, Hain finally landed a job at a Burger King. She promised to try to make the best of it. The Chipotle incident came up only once at her new job, when one of her colleagues mentioned the video. Hain decided to own her transgression. I cut her off like, girl, you're not going to believe it. That's me, Hain said. Hain had dealt with only one notably rowdy customer at the Burger King. One day in the drive-thru, a woman got 4-piece order of mozzarella sticks and asked for 8 packets of marinara sauce to go with it. One of Hain's colleagues told the woman she would have to charge her for the extra marinara. And the lady's like, what the F? Hain said. Eventually, a manager stepped in and made the woman pay for the extra sauce. Everyone went on with their day. But Hain had a different view of the situation. If I was on the drive-thru, here's your 8 effing sauces. Have a nice day, she told me. I know that the customer is always right, whether they're wrong or not. Give them what they want. For Russell, the encounter with Hain had affected her life in unforeseen ways. She had previously seen a doctor for a skin condition that flared up whenever she came in contact with something hot. She sometimes had trouble taking a warm shower. And when the chicken and rice hit her in the face, her skin started to feel like it was burning. She wanted to go to the hospital, but her district manager was unsympathetic. They were just like, stick it out. You're almost through, Russell said. It was 8 o'clock, and the restaurant was open until 11. Russell finished her shift with cheese on her uniform and sour cream in her long pink hair and had to stick around afterward to close up the kitchen. Going viral for having a burrito thrown in your face was a confusing, humiliating experience, and she still thought about the incident pretty much every day. The manager of her Chipotle quit a few weeks after the burrito bowl attack, and Russell was asked to take on the manager's responsibilities, albeit without a new title or a raise. When she asked for one, the company offered to bump her hourly rate by 10 cents. I was making $19.49, Russell told me, so I went up to $19.59. Russell quit a few weeks later. She quickly found another job at a Raising Cane's one town over, but she lasted just 4 months. I couldn't do it anymore, Russell told me. I couldn't deal with the customers. It didn't help that she had to take a pay cut to $16.50 an hour. This summer, Russell passed a state test to become a nurse aide and found a job at a nursing home where she was back up to the $19 an hour she made at Chipotle. When Hayne and I first spoke, she had just finished her 2 months at Burger King, which had gone well enough that the restaurant asked her to stay on. She could make better money delivering packages, but decided to stick with Burger King to impress Judge Gilligan, who still had to decide whether she would spend the final 30 days of her sentence in jail. Gilligan told me that he believed the experiment had worked. I got a letter from the general manager of the Burger King saying, "We like her, we're going to keep her," Gilligan said. He felt obliged to give Hayne a taste of what more severe punishment could be like, but let her go free after just 2 nights in jail. Hayne insisted that she had grown from the entire experience, but it wasn't immediately clear that 2 months of slinging burgers had done much to dampen the righteousness she still felt. Each time Hayne told me she had been wrong to throw the bowl, she followed it with a quick but and an insistence that the service had been bad enough to warrant a response. The experiment had also done little to inspire either woman to pursue any kind of reconciliation. The good news, if you want to call it that, is that the problem of dealing with the friction of other human beings is becoming increasingly moot. Last fall, a month after the incident at Parma, Chipotle announced that it was testing out a new robot that could work alongside others that can make tortilla chips. The robot's name was Chippy, and cut, core, and peel avocados for guacamole. It goes by Autocado. The newest Chipotle robot was even more advanced. It can't quite handle a tortilla yet, but it can take over the human job of filling a burrito bowl precisely calibrated to deliver Chipotle's standard portion sizes without any conversation or coaxing or arguing. There would be no need to learn how to empathize with the burrito bowl robot. If you throw your bowl back in disgust, there won't be anyone to hurt. This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in New Yorker magazine. And one of the obituaries: the Army Ranger who became a songwriter and heartthrob. Chris Christopherson, 1936-2024. When Chris Christopherson decided to become a songwriter in 1965, his parents stopped speaking to him. His father, an Air Force general, wanted him to accept a post at West Point teaching literature. It was the perfect job for an Army Rangers captain with a master's degree from Oxford University, and it made solid sense now that he was near 30 with a wife and two children. Instead, Christopherson moved to Nashville, where he swept floors and emptied ashtrays at Columbia Studios, and soon wrote one of the most celebrated lyrics in pop history. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. The author of Me and Bobby McGee helped me make it through the night, and Sunday morning coming down would continue to defy expectations, becoming the thinking woman's leading man in film and every man's grizzled troubadour in song. Inspiration to pursue this creative path came while studying William Blake at Oxford. The fiery poet was a wonderful example for somebody who wanted to be an artist, Christofferson said in 1999. He believed if you were cut out to be one, it was your moral responsibility to be one, or you'd be haunted throughout your life and after death, till eternity. Christofferson was born in Brownsville, Texas, the eldest of three children. He majored in literature at Pomona College, where he boxed and played varsity football when he wasn't writing prize-winning stories and singing folk songs. After graduating in 1958, he spent 2 years at Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship, studying English literature. To fulfill his family's expectations, said the Washington Post, he joined the Army, spending years piloting helicopters as an airborne ranger. Stationed in Germany, he began to rebel against the trajectory of his life, boozing and wrecking cars. After leaving the military, he started riding with a crew that would later define outlaw country, said the New York Times. He spawned a Nashville legend when he landed a helicopter at Johnny Cash's house to deliver his demo tape. Cash wasn't home, but would later claim he saw Christofferson lurch across the lawn with the tape in one hand and a beer in the other. As his writing matured, he explored themes of freedom and commitment, alienation and desire, darkness and light, in hits for other artists. The 1970s brought meteoric fame as Cash's version of Sunday Morning and Janis Joplin's cover of Bobby McGee topped the charts. Christofferson released solo albums to middling success, but once he started acting, he became one of the biggest stars of the decade. Sam Peckinpah cast him as Billy in Pat Carrot and Billy the Kid, 1973, while Martin Scorsese made him the love interest in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, 1974. Movie star gorgeous with a roguish grin and electric blue eyes, he would appear in more than 50 films, said NPR.com, and win a Golden Globe opposite Barbara Streisand in the blockbuster A Star Is Born, 1976. He kept churning out songs, too, scoring Grammys for duets From the Bottle to the Bottom and Lover Please with his second wife, Rita Coolidge. More hits came in the 80s and 90s when he joined the Highwaymen, a supergroup of charismatic and much-loved country greats, including Cash, Willie Nelson, and Waylon Jennings. Christofferson made headlines in 1992 when he stood up for Sinead O'Connor after she was booed for criticizing the Catholic Church. He later wrote a song for her. After he began to experience memory loss in the 2000s, he was diagnosed with Lyme disease and retired to Maui with his third wife, entertaining visits from his eight children. I've had so much blessing, so much reward for my life, that I want to stay right where I am, he said in 2015. On a beautiful island with no neighbors and 180 degrees of empty horizon. It's a beautiful view. And we'll wind down the show with some of the short pieces on the Talking Points page. Five death row inmates in five states, South Carolina, Missouri, Texas, Oklahoma, and Alabama, were executed over the course of 7 days in late September, the highest weekly total in more than two decades. The U.S. has put to death 1,600 inmates since the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty in 1976. In 2022, government aid programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security accounted for at least a quarter of personal income in just over 50% of all U.S. counties. In 1970, about 1% of the counties drew a similar share of income from safety net programs. Government money has become a larger share of Americans' incomes as the country's population has grown older and more communities have fallen into economic decline. More than 10,000 books were banned by public schools during the 2023-24 academic year, nearly triple the number banned in 2022-23, according to PEN America. Iowa and Florida were together responsible for about 8,000 of the bans. Among the titles barred from the shelves for the first time last year were Agatha Christie's Death on the Nile and Alex Haley's Roots. Six convicted criminals who were granted clemency by Donald Trump during his presidency have since been charged with new crimes, including fraud, assault, and drug possession. At least three other people have been convicted of crimes that predated their grants of clemency. On the poll watch, 54% of Latino voters support Kamala Harris, while 40% say they'll vote for Donald Trump. And 64% of voters would like to see a second debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. And we'll finish the program today with a quote from Molly Ivins, quoted in the New York Times. She says, "Being slightly paranoid is like being slightly pregnant. It tends to get worse." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. It's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.